welcome back to the program. And for any of us who have often wondered how we got to this point where we are working to serve an economy that mindlessly devours precious resources rather than the economy serving the interests of human beings and their habitats, today we're joined by Rian Eisler, whose new book is titled The Real Wealth of Nations. Very pleased to welcome her to the program. You may recognize her name from another book that's very well known, The Chalice and the Blade. Welcome to EcoTalk.
Pleasure to be with you.
So, first of all, is it fair to say that it's time to return to the notion that the economy should serve us rather than us serving the economy? And one particular example that just came up this week, we interviewed someone who started a great new service called 41 Pounds. It's about junk mail, that each of us Americans gets 41 pounds of junk mail on average. None of us want it. It's a tremendous waste of resources. And I got an email from a listener who said, "You didn't give the other side of the story. I work for the U.S. Post Office. If we were to get rid of junk mail, that would be the collapse of the U.S. Postal Service." And I wrote back and said, "Well, if the crux of your business model is, you know, based on waste and wasting resources and time and energy, you've got a problem there. I think you should go back to the drawing board." And he took offense at that. This is just a small example, I think, of what you're referring to. How did we, you know, get to this place where things are kind of upside down in many ways?
Well, that's exactly what The Real Wealth of Nations shows, that we have really inherited an economic system, whether it is capitalist or socialist, that is upside down, where basically the most essential work, I mean, the title is The Real Wealth of Nations, and that is not financial. That consists of the contributions of people and of nature. So we need an economic system, economic indicators, economic policies, business policies, practices that care for people and for nature. But, you know, if you look at our economic indicators, it is really bizarre. I mean, you look at gross domestic product, and not only does it include activities that actually harm and even take life, like making cigarettes, the health bills, the funeral bills, but it fails to include the activities without which there would be no economy, no workforce, nothing, namely the life-sustaining activities, first of all, in households, the so-called women's work of caring and caregiving, the volunteer economy, and the natural economy. So what the Real Wealth of Nations does is to start with proposing that we need to go beyond socialism and capitalism, maintain the good elements of both, but move toward what I call a caring economics that at long last gives visibility and value to the life-sustaining work.
Caring economics, those are two words you just don't ever see together. How do we get to this place of uncaring economics?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, Betsy, because I realized, as I wrote the book, that just putting caring and economics in the same sentence is really, as they say these days, thinking outside the box.
Radical.
But it's a terrible comment, isn't it, on both economics and on our value system. So we got to change that. Well, how we get there is everything starts with awareness, with consciousness. But there are also in the Real Wealth of Nations some very, very practical approaches that every one of us can be involved in. For example, let's start with the so-called bottom line, because that's, you got to go to where people are sometimes. Well, in a chapter called Caring Pays in Dollars and Cents, I've got a lot of data showing how investing in caring policies is actually terrific for the bottom line. Just one example, a study showed that companies that invest in child care, the return on investment over 4 years was a whopping 500%.
Mm. Now, you're an eminent social scientist, a peace, human rights, and environmental activist, not just an author, of course. How do you think that we can take this and turn it around? You're almost like a world therapist. You have a really broad view, and I think you've got your finger exactly on the problem, or at least a big chunk of it. How do we get from there to here, or here to there?
We've got to change the economic rules of the game so that those companies that are more caring really can do it and be rewarded for it. So we are really talking about changing the conversation about economics. Yes, starting to talk about caring economics, and putting caring and economics in one sentence. Talk about, for example, people's life-work balance. Again, something that people are really suffering from. Well, explain to them how in nations such as Sweden and Norway and Finland, the Nordic nations, people aren't as stressed. Why? Because these nations have more support, fiscal, monetary support for caring and caregiving. For example, they have very generous paid parental leave. I mean, here in California, we're thrilled that we finally have the first paid parental leave law in the United States, and it is so pathetically limited. It's a start, but we can support policies like that. As for environmental housekeeping, we've got to really understand something, that what we're talking about here are values. And our economic system reflects a system of values in which cleaning up the environment, you know, that's women's work. Caring for people, that's women's work, and it's been systematically devalued. So, yeah, we got to start thinking about what I call the economic double standard, where, again, anything associated with women and the stereotypically feminine has been invisible, and it's got to change.
Should we begin by changing the GDP and what makes up the gross domestic product for
Absolutely.
This new century?
And let me tell you something. That's, you know, it's not simple. You certainly can't put a monetary value on everything. I mean, how can you put a monetary value on how we feel when we're cared for? On the other hand, you can put a monetary value on the work of caregiving, and nations are beginning to even do it. For example, in 2004, Switzerland included the unpaid work of caring and caregiving done in households. And you know what they found? They found that if that work were included in the Swiss GDP, it would constitute 70%. It is not that it can't be done. In fact, as early as 1995, the United Nations Human Development Report, because that was the United Nations conference in Beijing on women that year, they estimated that if the unpaid work of mostly of caring and caregiving performed by women worldwide were included, it would come to a whopping $11 trillion per year. And they said, well, if that work were included in statistics, policymakers could no longer ignore it. Of course, policymakers ignore all kinds of things, but it's a start, as you say.
I noticed in your bio you are eminently qualified to talk and write about compassion. You were a Holocaust survivor, and your family just barely escaped in Vienna on a boat bound for Cuba. I understand you grew up there, both pre- and post-revolution. And how did that shape your thinking and your work?
Well, it really set me on this passionate quest to find answers to questions like, does it have to be this way? I mean, we're a species so capable of caring, of empathy. What has pushed us back? And as you may know, my work introduces a whole new way of thinking of society that takes us beyond capitalism versus socialism, or right versus left, or religious versus secular, or north versus south, or east versus west, and so on. What I call the partnership system and the domination system. And it's a way of constructing relationships, beliefs, and institutions. But what distinguishes my work is that I don't leave out where we all live, like most so-called serious studies. I start with our family and other intimate relations, gender, parent-child relations, because why? Because how we're taught to look at relations in those affects everything. It affects how we construct all other relations. So my work is really systemic. And yes, it points to, for example, that if we're serious about poverty, 70% of those living in absolute poverty in our world are female. In the United States, in this wealthy country, women over the age of 65 are twice as poor as men over 65 as a group. It's because we don't give visibility and value to caring and caregiving. I mean, these were mostly former caregivers or still are. We can have caregiving tax credits. We can, as I said, have better paid parental leave, better investment in child care. We've got it all backward, don't we?
We do.
And it's got to change.
I talk a lot about practicing compassionate conservation.
Well, that's what we've got to do. And yes, we've got to take a systemic approach because we simply don't value life-supporting work, be it the work of nature or, yes, the so-called women's work of caring for people in households.
Rion, we're out of time. I so hate to cut this interview short. We're going to have you back. Very interesting concepts and a great book. It's called The Real Wealth of Nations. We've been speaking with Rion Eisler. She's the author of a best-selling book you probably have heard of, if not read, called The Chalice and the Blade. Good luck with the book. I'm going to recommend it and pass it around in every circle I can. And good luck with it. And thanks for your work.
It's been a pleasure speaking with you, Betsy.
When we come back, we'll speak with Tim Little. He's working within the confines of today's economy, trying to make companies, including Apple Computers, accountable for the toxic chemicals inevitably released from their products. Stay with us.